Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we sit down for 9 innings of conversation with Ernie Westfield, who pitched in baseball's Negro Leagues and now conveys his ballpark memories through poetry. We hear about the history of sleaze paperbacks in the 1960s, and we learn how Bloomington Normal was an off-season training ground for circus aerialists. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Spring means the start of a new sporting season. But instead of the sport that features bats and bases, AM580's Tom Rogers attended a recent event in Springfield with a lot of heavy lifting and a 1,000-year history.
When you walk into the State Fairgrounds Coliseum, an open, dirt-floored place where they hold livestock exhibitions, you notice two things right off the bat: the lack of heat and Celtic music. Fitting on both counts, it's approaching St. Patrick's Day. Any British Isles references are welcome here, and the chill is typically Scottish, even if those wearing the kilts and showing off their athletic prowess may not be completely used to it.
Is this going to be on the air? There's a big shrinkage factor.
That's Merle Lawless, who coordinates the annual Shamrock Games for the St. Andrew Society.
No, the athletes, almost in any sport, when you're playing football, you don't hear the crowd, you don't feel the rain. These guys aren't feeling the cool coldness at all.
Each year, Lawless's group, Ancient Athletics, invites competitors from all over for the games. They're based on activities the Scots of 1,000 years ago may have been doing in everyday life, strenuous things.
Ah! You know, logs and stones and bales of straw 1,000 years ago when clans competed against each other. This is what they had available, and the reason they were competing at first was to find out what athletes would come to the top and who might be the better warriors.
We have another round of qualifying. We got Will's up.
The caber toss may have the highest profile of Scottish games events. It's being held just outside the Coliseum, and it's tougher than it looks. Here, the novice participants are trying to maneuver a 15-foot-long, 6-inch-wide wooden pole, or caber. The trick is to pick it up solidly at the bottom and hoist it into vertical position for the throw.
There you go. Oh, get out!
Once you have it in place, hovering over your hands, you run with it and throw it off, hoping it'll roll end over end right in front of you.
There you go.
Wow.
Bring it in, Pull it in. There you go. Pull.
Oh! How do you turn it from up here?
Success is measured based on a clock face. If you do it right, the result is what the pros call a 12 o'clock throw. If you don't keep your balance...
Whoa. Doing the caber dance.
Well, you get 3 attempts. Dan Gashaw is a big, muscular guy, a football coach at nearby Ursuline Academy, and for a while he played arena football for a living. He's also had experience with some of the categories that are close to the track and field events we're all familiar with. The stone throw is essentially the shot put with a bigger weight. And the hammer throw involves a weight on the end of a short pole. Participants twirl around before they let it go for distance. But Gashaw admits in other events he's an absolute rookie.
I don't think I'll do too good on the caber or the sheaf toss or even the weight over bar, because that's a lot of technique. Hammer, I think I just got lucky and got a really good release on the 62 I throw. I honestly didn't expect myself to do that good.
So, I mean, there is a technique to all these events.
Oh, there's always a technique. I've coached track for a couple years and also thrown, and people think it's all about muscle. And there's a lot of technique involved in all this stuff. You got to know how to control the weight without the weight controlling you.
You heard Gashaw refer to another uniquely Scottish event, the sheaf toss, where athletes pick up a heavy burlap sack, or sheaf, with a pitchfork and hurl it over a horizontal bar. The Springfield Shamrock Games are kind of like a spring training for the Celtic game season. People from rank amateurs all the way up to professionals, yes, a small group of athletes do this for pay, are invited to events all through the warmer months.
Oh! Took
about 5 feet off of that one, flatty. We're flat on you.
Kerry Overfelt from Kentucky and three fellow pro competitors made it up. They're getting in shape for the national and world championships later on.
I lived in Glasgow, Kentucky. After I got out of college playing football, wanted something to do competitively. Picked up the games just as, you know, something to do, kind of spur of the moment. Looked kind of fun, and lucky enough, God blessed me to be athletic enough to turn pro. It gets to a point to where there's really not any more competition or anything else you can do. You know, you have to have certain goals set. I had a few goals set. I met all those goals and then just kind of decided, you know, look, it's time to get out of the amateurs and just turn pro.
Shamrock Games coordinator Merle Lawless says part of the fun of Scottish Games is they're not hard to learn, and those with Celtic bloodlines get a taste of their heritage.
The athletes throw because they love to compete, but when they start researching their heritage and they start finding their tartan, their kilt, you know, at first they joke about wearing a kilt. They're, you know, embarrassed, and people call it a skirt. But after a while, you realize what you're doing and the heritage that you have involved, and the kilt becomes something really special to you. And you're proud to wear your kilt, and you're proud to wear your colors.
But you don't have to be Scottish to play. Names like Verbanek and Schweska and Sanchez dot the list of competitors. And Ryan Vieira is a three-time world champion. Nor is it strictly a man's dominion. The 75 competitors in Springfield included a few in the women's division. Lawless says he and others find the Scottish Games a very comfortable stage to compete on.
I'm not going to be a marathon runner. I don't have the body type for that. But when I first saw a couple guys throwing the Scottish Hammer, I was hooked the first time they let me throw. And it's just something about throwing and competing that all these guys share. They really just enjoy being able to do that.
And when you've trained for months to throw around heavy objects, no one ever, ever makes fun of your kilt. For Sidetrack, I'm Tom Rogers.
The St. Andrew Society of Central Illinois holds its main Celtic Games when the weather gets warmer, May 21st, again at the State Fairgrounds. You're listening to Sidetrack. NASCAR's Daytona 500 was originally held on the sands of Daytona Beach, Florida. While the race has since been moved into a stadium with a paved track, there are still plenty of drivers who compete on dirt tracks across America, including in Western Illinois. Doug Smith spoke with some of the people involved with the Macomb Speedway and has this report.
Mid-1960s, records meant vinyl. Television programs were shown in black and white, and fuel injection on a car meant putting the gas pedal down halfway when starting it up. It was also a time when the Macomb Speedway was started. The 1/5 mile track is made of dirt and is illuminated by halogen utility lamps. It is here that racers throughout the tri-states meet on summer Saturday nights to compete. This is the world where Nextel is a racing series, where taking a poll has nothing to do with politics, and it's where you'll find Bill Goddard. He is the owner of the Macomb Speedway. He is also the referee, the manager, and even the race announcer. Like most everyone involved with the Speedway, Goddard got his start behind the wheel.
I started with one of the four-cylinder race cars. Mine was a Volkswagen, of course, but that's how I began, and just every week started from there, you know, type thing.
For the winter season, the track lays dormant, but those involved with the track do not. Drivers take the time to update and tune their cars, and Goddard organizes the features and events for the upcoming year. He's looking forward to starting off the 2005 season in May and is hoping to clear up the misconceptions about who exactly is a stock car fan.
There's really more people involved in racing than what they think, and the numbers, like we relate to earlier, you know, there's a lot of fan-based people out there that like stock car racing.
During a race, there is a wild mix of sounds. Fans cheer, engines scream, and announcers try to keep up with all the action. Last September, Steve Smith won the Super Street Stock Car Championship. What you just heard was the last few seconds of the race that decided it all. Smith says he's happy about winning the title and is looking forward to the coming season.
I put more pressure on. I want to do it again. I'm not satisfied with just doing that. I make sure it's not just a fluke or something like that. I try harder and hopefully build a better car, and hopefully we'll have some more good luck and be able to do it again.
Smith got his start after high school. He visited the track on Saturday nights with friends and decided he wanted to be a part of it all. He says instead of trying to explain the speedway to others, they should come to the track and experience it for themselves.
There's still a lot of people that don't go to local tracks. They just, and then once they do, they're hooked, you know. But lots of people, you know, they're like, oh, where are you racing? Like, oh, they got a track down there? Yeah, you know, but they watch it every week on TV. It seems almost like it's different people.
She's real fine, my 409.
Dennis Schulte and his son race in the four-cylinder stock car class called the Wild Things. Some of the rules for this class include you must have a working horn, and if it wasn't put under the hood at the factory, it doesn't belong there. Schulte says for those concerned about costs, this is the easiest class to get involved in.
You know, you could do this for a summer for $1,000 and have a great time. And as far as Macomb goes, man, I love that place. It's been good to me. I've had a lot of fun over there with the other drivers. I've got a lot of respect for them, and they've always treated me kind.
Both Schulte and his son Tyler hold trophies for winning the Wild Thing stock car class at the Macomb Speedway. Dennis Schulte says getting to race weekend nights on the same track as his son is even better than winning a championship.
I'd like to explain. I mean, I'd like to be able to tell folks how much, how blessed I feel to, you know, just have the opportunity to go out there and play with him on a Saturday night. Boy, that is a great time.
After all the time, the money, and the stress, the wins and the losses, Schulte feels it's worth the cost. Beep, 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 yeah. Melissa Watkins is a mother of two and the wife, daughter, and aunt of Speedway drivers. She is also a driver. Behind the wheel of her John Deere green and yellow Dodge, Watkins spends Saturday nights helping out the family of racers and competing in the street cruiser class. Watkins credits her husband for getting the family started in racing.
He kind of started this whole gang out, and now it's my husband and me and my dad and my nephew. So it started out with him. He started out in a four-cylinder bomber a long time ago, and now he's up to a late model, and he's the one that originally started it.
Watkins says any woman wanting to get involved in stock car racing should do so.
Well, don't be afraid of it. I mean, yeah, it's a guy, you know, it's mostly a guy's sport, but don't be afraid of it because it's a lot of fun. If you can drive a car down the road, you know, you can soon figure out how to drive a car around the track.
Watkins says there is a simple reason why she's at the track on Saturday nights. She has fun doing it. While Smith, Schulte, and Watkins might not be known by many race fans, most do know the names Richard Petty and Dale Earnhardt. These Babe Ruths of stock car racing also started on dirt tracks and quickly rose to professional driving. They're now considered to be NASCAR legends. Another racer who started on dirt is Carl Edwards, who races his number 99 Ford Taurus every Sunday. The 25-year-old placed 12th in the Daytona 500, which has been called the Super Bowl of professional stock car racing. What sets him apart from other big-time drivers is that he started on the dirt track of the Macomb Speedway, the same dirt track which will again come alive May 14th with the start of the 2005 racing season in Macomb. I'm Doug Smith. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Sidetrack. Baseball's Negro Leagues existed primarily at a time without acceptance, during a period of segregation. The first Negro League was formed in 1920, and over 2,600 players would compete over the next 40 years. The league's heyday was made up with the likes of pitcher Satchel Paige, catcher Josh Gibson, and an infielder by the name of Jackie Robinson, who would break baseball's color barrier in 1947, ultimately meaning the demise of the league. Ernie Westfield and his pitching arm came along at a later time. While he didn't experience some of the success of those previously mentioned, he at least had the opportunity that wasn't given to him by Major League Baseball. Jeff Bossert sat down with Westfield for 9 innings of reflection and poetry.
Like many Negro League players, Ernie Westfield says when he and his teammates took to the diamond, there were two major leagues, because his league's brand of baseball was every bit as good, and sometimes better.
And now, the starting lineup for your University of Illinois Fighting Illini.
Rather than meet Westfield in a studio, we took advantage of spring weather and decided to use Illinois Field as a backdrop for the Fighting Illini baseball home opener against Indiana State. We grab a seat near the visitor's dugout.
Now see how he's keeping that ball down? That's what you have to do. You keep it down, so if he hit it, he'll pop it up or hit it on the ground.
Westfield pitched 6 years with the Birmingham Black Barons, but I came to learn that wasn't his original plan.
Well, you know, it was a very strange situation originally out of high school. I signed with the Cubs, and I was signed by Buck O'Neill, who is now with the museum down in Kansas City. And after a stint with the Cubs organization, after playing down in Carlsbad, New Mexico, Morristown, Tennessee, the Cubs released me. So I went back to Knoxville, Tennessee, tail between my leg, disappointed. So my dream was to play professional baseball. And then one day I noticed that there was a sign posted that said that the Birmingham Black Barons was going to be coming to Knoxville, Tennessee. And so people there knew that I was a pitcher, and they had me to pitch against them. And so I beat them. And next thing I know, they were asking me to go on the road with them at a rate of pay of $280 a month, which I never received. And that's how I got hooked up with the Negro League. Matter of fact, when I was young, I had never heard of the Negro League. I always wanted to play in the White League, and my idol was a guy by the name of Carl Erskine, who was a pitcher for the Dodgers. And later, when people started to ask me, when I became a Negro League player, who did I idolize when I was growing up, I said Carl Erskine. And they said, well, what about Don Newcomb, Joe Black? They tried to pick a black person for me to relate to. And I said, no, it was Carl Erskine. And they kept naming other black ball players that maybe I should have wanted to be like. And then finally I said, it's okay to be like Mike. And so they dropped it. They got my point.
So you really came along at a time when the Negro Leagues weren't, it was beyond its heyday.
Yes. Yeah,
we're talking about late 50s?
Late 50s. But we continued to play all the way up to 1967, 68. And some of the teams played all the way up to 1973. The Indianapolis Clowns continued to play. What happened is that the gentleman who bought the Birmingham Black Barons lived here in Champaign, Illinois. His name was Wardell Jackson. And he brought the teams here. He brought the Birmingham Black Barons, the Kansas City Monarchs, the Detroit Stars, the Philadelphia Stars. We all came to Champaign.
And Westfield says he can still bring it.
Well, a lot of times I'll just throw with my sons if they come by the house. I do the vocational end of it for Cunningham Children's Home, and I'll throw with kids there. And I'll throw every chance I get. I carry my glove with me just about everywhere I go.
Whoa!
See ya!
As a homer by the opposition sails over the left field fence, we talk about the art of hitting and the ultimate embarrassment for every batter from Little League to the major leagues.
Well, you know what? There's a poem that I wrote. It's called The Strikeout. And it says, the first pitch I really didn't see because the ball was so fast, it scared the devil out of me. The second pitch I saw just a tiny little bit, but before I could swing, the ball was in the catcher's mitt. The third pitch came at me, so I moved out of the way. I didn't know it was a curveball. Otherwise, I would have swung away. I don't know who the pitcher was, but they said Satchel was his first name. And I would have gotten a hit had they taken Satchel out of the game. Yes, I struck out and didn't swing at a single pitch. But I know what to do next time if I get another chance to hit. The kids love that. They love the strikeout. It happens to so much. That's your worst fear.
When did you start writing poetry, or how did you realize you could?
I started writing at a very young age because I stuttered. All I could do was write poetry and play baseball. And I felt that if I could do something where I didn't have to talk that much, that people wouldn't laugh at him. So baseball was a sport. You know, as a pitcher, I could talk to myself, but I didn't have to talk to the other player. I could just nod and shake my head. I could listen, you know. So I started writing poetry at a very young age. That's going to fall. Oh, no, it's not.
Ernie Westfield says he still talks baseball a lot these days by addressing kids in a vocational education program at Urbana schools. Westfield says he expects to release a book of his 60 to 70 poems, some concerning baseball, some not, in the next few months. As for the game, the Illini opened the home portion of their season by defeating the Indiana State Sycamores 8-4. I'm Jeff Bossert.
Sidetrack. Engineer Bill Hammack has been doing some traveling lately, and a few of the places he's visited has caused him to reflect on our approach to recycling and some changes that might be in order.
Last month, I traveled through the Pacific Northwest in California. At every stop, I heard about Seattle's new tough recycling laws. Toss too much junk mail and cardboard in the trash instead of the recycle bin, and you'll be fined. Seattle makes mandatory the recycling of everything that can be recycled. From an engineer's viewpoint, this just doesn't make environmental sense. Now, before those nasty emails and letters start arriving, let me emphasize. I said it made no sense to recycle everything that can be recycled. I certainly didn't say all recycling made no sense. Partly these laws arise because of a commonly held view that we toss, say, plastic soda bottles into the recycle bin and they go back to the manufacturer and they produce another bottle. In other words, a vision of a self-sustaining cycle of life. But the economy of recycling materials is more complex than this. For example, only a bit of a recycled plastic bottle ends up in a bottle again. Instead, it appears in carpets. Half of all polyester carpets come from plastic soda bottles. And there are other issues that determine the use of recycled materials. The cost of picking them up, it typically costs double that of regular trash. Greater cost means additional trucks, fuel, and sorting facilities, all of which take an environmental toll. This critique, though, has the same flaws as the Seattle recycling laws. It's what an engineer calls an end-of-the-pipe strategy. In other words, only years after making something do we consider how to dispose of it. Instead, we need to focus on green design, on designing consumer products from the get-go to be reused or disposed. Here's an example. The 2-liter soda bottle has a plastic label, which is different than the body of the bottle. So, to recycle this, the two different types of plastic must be separated. In the past, recyclers used a simple flotation technique. The plastic in the bottle sunk, the labels floated. Recently, the manufacturers put a roadblock in the way. They changed the type of plastic used in the label to one that also sinks. So, here are some simple rules for manufacturers to incorporate green design in their products. Make sure the components separate easily so no dissimilar materials remain together. Make sure common tools like hammers, screwdrivers, and pliers will suffice to get it apart. Design it so one person can disassemble it in 30 seconds or less. And lastly, be sure each material type can be identified through markings. So, to be environmentally friendly, we want products designed so that the high-value materials can be removed. Reserving recycling for metals, using the plastic and wood products for energy-producing incineration, and then, and I know that this will bring in the letters, take the rest to a landfill.
The comments of Bill Hammack, who teaches chemical engineering at UIUC. His commentaries on engineering and life, which to him are one and the same, can also be found on the web at engineerguy.com. Still to come on the program, Slee's paperbacks of the 1960s, Bloomington Normal's circus history, and beef jerky. Stay tuned. You're listening to Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. They had titles like Sinner's Town, Love Addict, Sin on Wheels, and Sideshow Siren. They were part of a now almost forgotten facet of popular culture. They were the sleaze paperbacks of the 1960s. A history of these books has just been published in a collection called Sin-A-Rama. It's put out by Farrell House. I recently chatted with one of the editors, Adam Parfrey, who we last talked with in August 2003 after the publication of It's a Man's World, Men Adventure Magazine's The Post-War Pulps. I asked Parfrey first to explain what a sleaze paperback is.
Well, sleaze, that's a term that was attached to those types of books by collectors, about a decade ago or a little earlier. And that term implies these books were just basically exploitation knockoffs and put out for the purpose of money and not specifically for the value of the writing itself. However, I have a fondness for that whole genre of sleaze because regardless of whether they were done for money or not, a lot of talented people were working on them. And there's some pretty incredible things they were able to do that they wouldn't be able to get away with if, in fact, they were going through the long-winded perspective of a regular publishing company. They have to do something that's acceptable by the whole family, for example, or they have to do something that's sort of like hits the mainstream in a way that's not offensive to anybody. These books really went ahead and went forward, and they didn't care whether it offended people. And actually, this loosened them a lot of the writing and particularly the artists up to do some amazing renditions that you wouldn't see ordinarily because they had a freedom. They had a freedom because they weren't expected to do something that extremely reasonable and rational.
Well, you were talking just a second ago about how the writers, these were writers who had made careers for themselves in other genres, especially science fiction. And there's an essay in there by Robert Silverberg that when that whole market of the 1950s sci-fi magazine, the last bits of the pulp magazine era died out, these guys didn't have anything to write, or really didn't have like a steady paycheck coming in, so they wrote this type of stuff. So, I mean, you actually had real professional writers, quality writers,
mm-hmm.
sort of slumming to do this sort of thing, but not really. This helped them hone their craft.
Certainly it did, because when you write a lot and write and you're forced to write and you're forced to get in front of the typewriter, it was a typewriter at the time, not a word processor. I remember when I did like a daily newspaper writing, it did improve my writing because you really had to express yourself quickly and thoroughly, and you couldn't procrastinate and put things off like a lot of writers do who feel like they're writing for the National Book Award.
Well, of course, you know, a lot of these writers wrote under pseudonyms, and in fact, you have an index in the back who the authors were, what their pseudonyms were. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they, have, of course, have more than one, and sometimes more than one author used the same name.
Right, right.
I mean, how hard is it to track down actually who did what?
Well, we were in touch with a lot of the editors at the time. Earl Kemp was the major one. But there are other publishers or editors who knew who was what and who did what. A lot of these people have died since, but that they've revealed your. It was a known fact within people within the world that Ed Lawrence Block wrote so-and-so things, and that Harlan Ellison wrote this and this under this name, because he worked with these people. And so it's a matter of getting in touch with those people. Still and all, after all that being said, there are a lot of not known, you know, books that there are not known who the actual writer is, even by all the collectors we have now, even by all the, you know, researchers we might have now, or the editors and publishers are still alive who could reflect on that information. Because they were really publishing quite a bit at the time, and you know, if you're doing 5-10 books a month and that cranking them out in 1960, often you don't recall who was involved, you know.
Well, one name that definitely stands out that I'm sure people will recognize is Ed Wood Jr., the guy behind Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Ed Wood was unusual in this regard because he insisted on them using his actual name. And he got angry when they substituted Ed Wood or Edward D. Wood Jr. with a pseudonym. And he wanted the fame that a book credit would give him, no matter how the book would be regarded by the public at large.
Well, the big thing behind using the pseudonyms and kind of not wanting to be known is because of the subject matter of these books. I mean, they were very lurid because they always, they most of the time had titles that used the word sex or sin or something like that, and had these very lurid covers to them.
Yeah, the title we used for the book, Sin-A-Rama, Sin-A-Rama, was actually, in a different spelling, was used as a book cover. But Cinerama, but I didn't want people to be mistaken that this is a takeoff on a type of film used in the 60s.
But, yeah. I mean, but the concept was these were very, you know, they were, you know, sexually charged books, but compared to now, they're relatively tame, too.
Mm-hmm.
And this was also sort of a transition point between the much harder stuff.
Yeah. It's just extraordinary, really, to look back and see the things we take for granted now, you know, things that are just something that could be sold on a supermarket newsstand now would be jail-worthy back then.
So what's the appeal of this genre of book to the collector and I guess to you personally?
Well, the appeal is there's several things. One thing is the phenomenon itself, that it was an uncollected or really unknown about industry, a shadow industry, that people don't really know about, but nevertheless, the work was pretty phenomenal often, and if not phenomenal, really kitschy and weird and interesting because it was so offbeat and strange. And so there are certain reasons that collectors would be interested in it. One is that it's the rareness of it. The second part is that they might come across books that are not known by any other human being on planet Earth. That happened when we were putting this book together. I came across books that nobody knew about, and we published this. Yeah, oh, we must have. It says, you know, it was like from that point of view. So you can find stuff. It's sort of like being an archaeologist. Finding a dinosaur, rare dinosaur bone.
That was Adam Parfrey, one of the editors of Cinerama, sleaze-sex paperbacks of the 60s. It's published by Faro House.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. In southeastern Indiana, in the town of Westport, is a little store that sells beef jerky and nothing else. Ron and Jennifer Hughes opened up the Westport Jerky Store around the beginning of the year to serve as headquarters for their own brand of beef jerky named Dunes, after Ron's nickname. If you haven't eaten much of this marinated dried meat product, you may not realize how much competition already exists in the beef jerky market. You can even buy it on the internet. But the Hughes family is undaunted. Jim Meadows called up Ron Hughes at the Westport Jerky Store to find out more.
When did you get into the business of making beef jerky?
Oh, back in the late 70s, I used to do a lot of traveling with my grandparents, Ponslers, and we would go down to a lake called Lake Lockaloosa, Florida, and there was a little lodge that sold beef jerky. And it was the best stuff I'd ever ate in my life. And, man, I came home, and I never could find that flavor anywhere. So in the early 90s, after I got out of the military, I started experimenting with jerky and flavors and keeping logs and such. And I finally hit that recipe that I had tasted back in the 70s, and I had it logged down, and I just started making it for friends and family. And I got a terrific response. And so my wife, being business-oriented from a good business family, she said, hey, why don't we try and sell this product of yours? And we did, and I didn't know what I was getting into, and it's hit. It's hit big.
Now, I did a real unscientific survey of what's out there just in the easiest-to-buy beef jerky, which is products you buy in convenience stores, products like Jimmy Dean's and Jack Link's. It wasn't really anything to write home for. What is the difference between that sort of product and what you're making?
I think it's just the flavor. I really do. We're using good quality meat. We use only sirloin tip roast from Black Angus. When I do, like you mentioned, Jack Link's and everybody else, when I take my product into a package store or wherever and give it a try, I usually outsell even Slim Jim 5-1. And I don't know, I guess I got lucky. But they sure do like it.
I don't know if it's a secret recipe, but what do you put in it?
It's all on the package. It's just your basic ingredients. You've got your peppers, your salts, your powders, your soys, and there's nothing secret about it. It's just the way you do it.
Now, the store you have in Westport, are you just selling that product, or do you have other products there?
This is all we're selling at the moment is beef jerky.
Okay. Westport, it's not a very big town, is it?
No, it's not. If you blink your eyes, you'll miss it.
And it's out there on, Indiana Route 3?
Yes, it is.
So where does your business come from? It doesn't sound like you would have that much drive-by business or that much population out there.
We don't have a lot of walk-ins. We just, mainly wanted the shop to be in my hometown so that, what we made stayed in our community. But it's been out here so long just experimenting and stuff like that. I have a lot of liquor stores, bars, trade shows and stuff like that's a big hit.
So how far afield is your product circulating?
So far, Muncie, Indiana, and I believe Terre Haute has heard about it. And I've sent some to Tokyo, Japan with a friend of mine from work. I've sent pounds of it to Iraq for the soldiers. Buddies of mine will have either deer meat or whatever. I also will do deer meat. If you bring in your roast, boneless roast, we will turn it into our jerky.
Is it just a snack food or something that you would carry with you, say if you're going on a hike or something, or how do you enjoy eating beef jerky?
Me, I've got 2 16-year-old boys, and we weightlift, and it's 42% protein, our jerky is. So So we kind of use it as a protein supplement or whatever for exercise and weightlifting. If you were out on a hike or something like that, you have a pack of Dunes jerky in your backpack and you get a little hungry, 2 to 4 ounces will go a long way. It swells up and makes you feel full, and it's a lifesaver.
Do you feel that the interest in this product, and I mean beef jerky in general, is growing, or are you just reaching new customers among those people who already know about and appreciate beef jerky?
Yes, we are. We're reaching new customers. I've had, actually just today, I had people come to me and say, hey, I took some of your product home. My wife has never, ever ate beef jerky before or whatever. And she said it was okay, and then I stopped by Walmart and got some jerky, and she spit it out. And so she says, I can't eat anything but Dunes jerky. So we're just getting all kinds of new customers, and the response we get from this is the best jerky that we've ever ate, and so far that's 100%. I've never had anybody to say that it's not the best.
Do you have a final ambition or a master plan? How big would you like this business to get for you?
I want this business to get bigger than Slim Jim or Jack Link's I ever thought about getting. I want to take over the United States with Dunes Jerky.
That was Ron Hughes speaking from Westport Jerky, his store in Westport, Indiana, where he sells his own brand of Dunes Beef Jerky. Hughes still has to complete some paperwork before he can ship his product outside of Indiana, but you're welcome to visit his store, open Monday through Saturday on Westport's Main Street, just off Indiana Route 3. This is Sidetrack. From the late 1800s to the 1960s, Bloomington Normal was the off-season home for many famous aerialists. They would train in ice houses, tying their trapezes to rafters and falling into sawdust on the floor beneath. WILL-TV's Allison Davis Wood uncovered this history with the help of rare personal collections and the circus collection at Illinois State University. This segment originally aired on the program Prairie Fire.
Who can forget the thrill of watching the circus come into town? The excitement of the circus parade as it made its way down Main Street. Exotic animals from faraway places. The bustle and activity of the Midway. The colorful posters that lured us to exhibits both fascinating and disturbing. The smell of the sawdust inside the big top. The anticipation before the band strikes up the opening music. And the hush of the crowd just before the start of the marvelous acts of courage and skill performed right before our eyes. In its heyday, the larger circuses employed up to 1,500 performers and workers behind the scenes. Often two or three entire circus trains were needed to house and transport all of the people, animals, and equipment moving from one town to the next.
It was like a fantastic city. It set up in one day and tore down that night and was gone. And people were amazed by that. It was like a fantasy world that traveled all over.
Though it was not well publicized, Central Illinois was the winter training quarters for dozens of world-class aerial performers from the late 1800s through the 1960s and beyond. Circus historian Steve Gossard has traced the importance of Bloomington as a circus training center in many articles and lectures.
A few kids that ran away with the circus back in the 1870s, and they came back to Bloomington and trained other people who trained other people, and it sort of became kind of a family tree of circus performers.
Then in 1909, officials in charge of the newly constructed YMCA building in Bloomington offered their facilities to local aerial performers for training. In return, the performers agreed to an annual circus performance, the proceeds of which were returned to the Y. With the exception of the World War I years, the YMCA circus was an annual event until the early 1940s.
So it was kind of a unique reciprocal arrangement, where the community was supporting the circus people, and the circus people were supporting the community in their way.
One of the most influential aerial performers in Bloomington's early history was Eddie Ward. Along with his sister Jenny, Eddie Ward's double trapeze team was one of the premier flying acts in the country. Eddie was also instrumental in recruiting and training promising young flyers. In the 1920s, Eddie owned a house and a practice barn on Emerson Street in Bloomington, where many of the performers trained in the off-season. The house still stands to this day and is the home of the Grand Hotel restaurant. In this home video, one of Eddie Ward's most notable performers returns to the place where she had trained 60 years earlier. At age 17, Mickey King was a mere rookie in the circus until she got her big break from the great Eddie Ward.
And I went over, sat on the edge of the platform, and he says, come here. He says, let me see what you can do. He got me off. I chinned myself in the rings. He put me over on my one arm. I let go, and I held it with one hand. And he said, you know, would you like to come to Bloomington with us when the show closes and be one of my girls?
Mickey soon became a star with the Ward Troupe, learning routines on the rings and solo trapeze, and how to turn one-arm swings. She also recruited a young woman to the Ward group who became a key figure in the history of aerial performance, her sister Antoinette.
She came to visit me. She left the convent. She was going to, just ready to take her first four-year vows to become a sister. And she just fell in love with circus. She says, Mickey, can you get me a job? I said, I don't know, but I'll try. She says, you've got to, Mickey. If you don't get me a job, I won't go back. I'll jump in the river. She, and that's what I wanted to hear. I wanted to know that she really wanted to do it. I didn't entice her into anything.
Antoinette joined the Ward Troupe in 1927 and quickly became an accomplished performer in her own right. Then suddenly, the Ward dynasty came to an end when Eddie Ward contracted pneumonia.
When Eddie died in 1929, I left. I had to. I loved him so much. I just couldn't take it.
Mickey King continued performing in the circus and in vaudeville through the 1950s. In the meantime, Antoinette had married Art Cancello, one of the stars of the Flying Wards, and together they formed their own act, the Flying Cancellos. The Cancellos bought the barn on Emerson Street from Eddie Ward's widow and continued to train there through the 1950s. To this day, Art and Antoinette Cancello are regarded as two of the greatest aerial stars of all time. They enjoyed long careers in both performance and management in Ringling Brothers and other major circuses. The first catcher for the Flying Cancellos was a young Bloomington native named George Valentine. George's daughter Sherry still lives in the area and recalls the early days of her father's troupe, the Flying Valentinos.
Dad started about 1928. Harry Lamar taught him how to fly here in Bloomington at the YMCA. And so my dad, in turn, taught his brothers, and they all had their own flying acts.
George's plan was to form a troupe of women flyers who could perform the same routines as the men, with George himself serving as catcher. He found his star performer back home in Bloomington at the YMCA.
My mother would go up to the Y to watch them practice, and she was a young girl. And one day she was walking down the sidewalk, and my father and Walt Grable out front, they asked Mom if she'd like to learn how to fly. And she says, oh, I don't think I could. And my dad says, I didn't ask you if you could. I asked you if you wanted to learn how to fly. And so she joined the act, and in 1935 they were married.
With Lorraine Valentine in place, George hired Sue Pelto, another female flyer. And his dream of an all-girl flying troupe was complete. The Flying Valentinos were one of the most popular acts of the time due to the elegance and grace they brought to their profession. Here, Lorraine Valentine is seen performing her signature act, flying blindfolded with a burlap sack over her head. For practice in the off-season, George Valentine bought this barn on Grove Street in Normal. It also served as a home for the troupe, which now included the newest member of the family, daughter Sherry. Sherry was groomed to join the flying act from a very young age, but their plans soon changed.
My dad had a heart attack around 1950, so he had to stop catching. Dad made a small portable rigging that Mom and Sue could put up themselves. They had a small trapeze for me, so I did that. Started that when I was 3. We traveled with that for fairs and celebrations and shrine circuses too. At first I just did simple tricks like a bird's nest. As I got older, I did a neck swivel where you hang by your neck and the hook goes over the bar, the trapeze bar, and you spin real fast.
Growing up on the road had its challenges, but Sherry Valentine has only fond memories of her early years. The major benefit was forming many lifelong friendships with other circus performers.
A troupe would be like a family unit. They were a very close-knit group. They relied on one another for their very lives.
But along with the glamour and camaraderie of circus life, there were the risks and dangers faced by even the most accomplished performers.
My mother was performing probably in the late 30s, early 40s, probably doing a 2.5. She missed the catcher, my father, landed in the net wrong and hurt her neck. And they took her to the doctor. And the doctor said, you'd have to wait because there's a gentleman here who just had a heart attack from watching a young woman fall from the trapeze at the circus.
And with the constant presence of danger and injury, there was also the everyday grind of life on the road.
Some of them move at night, but some of them move, get up like at 5 in the morning, move to the next town, set it up, then have 2 shows, tear it down, and go to bed. In the meantime, the women have to go to the laundromat, have to go grocery shopping, have to get gasoline. The highlight of a circus performer's week is finding a lot right next to a laundromat in a Walmart.
By the 1950s, times had changed, and the Bloomington Normal area was no longer known as the capital of the world, as many circus flyers had once called it.
The reason that Bloomington died out was that during World War II, they suspended the performance in the YMCA. In the end, the management changed hands and that closed its doors to the professional circus performers here in town. But the circus professionals sort of became a little bit bitter about it. They felt that the community wasn't supporting them anymore, and that was sad to them. And they felt that they weren't getting that recognition that they got before.
But echoes of a bygone era still exist in the Bloomington area. The Milner Library at Illinois State University houses a permanent circus collection, which includes over 1,500 original circus posters and other memorabilia. The tradition of circus performance continues with Illinois State University's Gamma Phi Circus, one of the few places amateurs can receive training in the circus arts. The Grand Hotel, once a home to many of the stars of the Eddie Ward Troupe, has been a popular restaurant in Bloomington for years. Patrons can enjoy looking at photographs and posters there that recall the heyday of circus life in the area. And Sherry Valentine stays in touch with her friends in the circus world by publishing Backyard Magazine, a newsletter that blends current circus news with memories of the past. Her most cherished possessions are her family's circus mementos.
And I just like to go down in the basement and go through the trunks, and I have the rigging from the smaller trapeze, and I have my dad's catch bar, and it's just fun to go be alone in the basement and go through things and bring back memories and wonder, you know, what it would have been like if I would have been born earlier. I might have been up on the flying trapeze instead of just on the smaller one.
That feature from Allison Davis Wood comes from the WILL TV program Prairie Fire, which airs Wednesdays at 7:30 p.m. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and a lot of our past shows are also available as MP3 downloads. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.